Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation about our 100 notable books of the year and how we chose them.
We start with a list of probably 600 or more books culled from the reviews that we've done from the previous year's holiday issue.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Andrew Graham Dixon is here to discuss his new biography of Caravaggio.
This is a life lived with soldiers, mercenaries, pimps, prostitutes. A very dark and dangerous life.
And Gregory Coles has bestseller news.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
It's that time of the year again when the New York Times Book Review chooses its 100 notable books. And the guy who really honchos that, as he does so much of what we do here at the Book Review, is the great Bob Harris, our deputy editor. And he and I are going to talk about how we did it and why we did it and what we should have done instead and all the rest. Welcome, Bob.
Hi, Sam. How you doing?
All right. So we have 100 books. And let's remind listeners how many we kind of start with before we come up with this list.
We start with a list of probably 600 or more books culled from the reviews that we've done from the previous year's holiday issue. And we put them on a list. We distribute it among all the editors, get their opinions about what which book should stay. And then we start the very laborious cutting process.
It's tough, Bob, because people don't realize 100 books is not as huge a number as you might think.
Oh, absolutely. It actually comes out to fewer than two per issue because the cover reviews say in one other book from each issue, but then you have to subtract from that the issues during the year where we don't have a book on the cover, like the holiday issue and the 10 best in summer reading.
And so that means since we begin by reviewing, in the course of a year, we estimate 1-2% of all the books published. Now you're getting down to essentially, as you say, two books in each issue. It's a very select elite group. What are some of the criteria for making it? Let's say fiction. It's more or less roughly divided between fiction and nonfiction. So we're looking at maybe 45 to 50 novels or short story collections or works of poetry. What are we looking at there?
Yeah, this year I think it's 45 fiction, 55 nonfiction. What we do is we start with the ones called that are on Editor's Choice each week, and we comb through the issues and add books that didn't make Editor's Choice for one reason or another, usually because there's not enough space. That's how we form the big list. And then we go to the editors who've actually read the books and worked on the reviews that we've run and get their opinions about which one should stay. So we start out with over 600. The first cutting it in half isn't so hard. After that, basically, we've got 300 books that could be on the 300 notable books of the year.
Yeah, you know, and we try to explain to readers and also to publishers and authors, we don't pretend this is a scientific process. And nobody gets any money. There's no prize that comes with it. It's just a selection of notable books. We're not even saying they're the very best books or the most important. They're just notable in some way or other.
Yes, I think the word notable is important. It doesn't mean that they're excellent. It doesn't mean that there aren't equally excellent or equally good books that could have made the list. We base our choices partially on the reviews that the books got and partially on our editor's reaction to them. And then we just try to get a fairly good mix. And it's very hard because I could easily take off 10 and put 10 others on that are the books that are equally good.
So when you say mix, we're looking at different subject matters. Say for nonfiction, different subject matters, genres. There's a big vogue for science books these days, brain science books. So we'll look at maybe some of those, but don't want to weight the list down with 20 of them.
Exactly. We try to be fair in the genre thing and to reflect trends, but not to weight the list in any one given way.
Is it harder, Bob, for a work of fiction to make it than nonfiction? Or, I mean, you could make one argument, it's tougher for nonfiction because there's so much more of it published. On the other hand, you could say, well, a work of fiction has to be a superb work of art, and a work of nonfiction maybe doesn't have to be.
I think a work of nonfiction can be notable even if it's not a work of art because of its subject matter and the argument in the book, where novels and short stories do probably have to be a little higher on the literary scale to make it.
And so next week, Bob, we'll have our 10 best books of the year.
Chosen from the 100.
The winnowing and whittling continues. Thanks a lot, Bob.
Okay, Sam.
That's Bob Harris, the deputy editor of the New York Times Book Review.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson. It's the new book based on hundreds of interviews with Steve Jobs and the people around him. That's Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson. It's available from Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview. That's audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. First, happy holidays, Julie.
Happy holidays.
And we have news of a sort from Barnes & Noble, the last, the only of the great chains
left. The last man standing. Barnes & Noble said this week they announced their third quarter results, and it was slightly disappointing. They did miss analysts' expectations, and their shares tumbled about 12% during morning trading. But it definitely got a conversation going about the role of Barnes & Noble right now as we're heading into the holiday season, which is, of course, the biggest retail season in general, and definitely the biggest season for book sales. And Barnes & Noble is really the whole physical bookstore world, with the exception of independents, to itself now that Borders has gone bankrupt and liquidated earlier this year.
Julie, we hear this expression all the time now. I don't know when it began. Brick and mortar stores, the actual bookstore that someone would buy an actual book in. Is it really true that someone might stroll into Barnes & Noble, look at a title or a jacket that he or she likes, whip out their iPhone, and then order it from Amazon?
It happens all the time. And I hear this a lot from people who own their own bookstores, and you definitely hear it from Barnes & Noble. And really, Barnes & Noble's arch rival right now is Amazon. So the idea of their stores being used as showrooms is something that does not make them very happy. But it does happen all the time. Now, when you go into a Barnes & Noble store lately, you do see a lot of books, but you also see a lot of other things. I recently went into my local Barnes & Noble, and the first table was all books, and the two tables behind that were filled with toys and games, which has become a much bigger part of Barnes & Noble's business, especially during the holiday season. You also see a lot of Nook tables, where you have all of their different Nook e-reading devices, which are for sale now, and there are at least three of them, and they're quite cheap now.
Yes, Julie, the Nook has been kind of a savior for Barnes & Noble. Maybe that's overstating it. Certainly, it's become a very successful, profitable item for them. So this raises the question then of, well, if Barnes & Noble has got this great e-reader, then are they going to lose their potential customers to ebooks?
Well, Barnes & Noble has really had a major strategy shift over the last couple of years since they introduced their first e-reader. What they're hoping is that if a consumer comes into their store and they don't want to buy print books, then they'll pick up a Nook instead. And then, of course, they will remain Barnes & Noble customers because they'll still keep downloading Barnes & Noble ebooks. Now, Barnes & Noble has made incredible gains in the ebook market, of gains that have surprised most publishers. Right now, they have about 26% of the ebook market, which is pretty significant considering they had none of it a couple of years ago. Amazon has pretty much the rest of it. But what publishers are worried about right now is that with e-readers so inexpensive, when people are buying their holiday gifts this year, will they buy a $79 e-reader instead of the $30 hardcover book?
And what about the traditional book publishers? They're doing more and more ebooks themselves. And in fact, I will say, in our own New York Times book review, we're getting more advertising than we had in a while because it seems that ebooks are attracting readers. How do the book publishers themselves adjust to this rapidly transformed marketplace for their product?
Well, what they're doing now is every new book also has an ebook version of it. They, you know, in previous years, they perhaps wouldn't have released an ebook, but publishers are very consistent now. When they publish a book, they publish it in all formats, and they say they're doing this because they want to make their books available to consumers in any way they want it. So I think what they're worried about is that, you know, if Barnes & Noble is in trouble, and most publishers will say that they're very confident about Barnes & Noble right now. They need Barnes & Noble in many ways, but one reason is because they still need sales of print books because ebook sales have not offset the losses from print books so far.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Well, one of the truly notable books of the year is a new biography of the remarkable and unusual painter Caravaggio. It's called Caravaggio, A Life Sacred and Profane. It's by a truly distinguished biographer and art historian, Andrew Graham Dixon, reviewed for us by another distinguished figure, Hilary Sperling, who calls it a gripping biography that brings Caravaggio to life for the 21st century. I'm delighted that Andrew is here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Thank you.
So Caravaggio, in some ways, the artist of the moment. Everybody's fascinated by him. What made his life sacred and profane?
Well, he spent his life painting for the church at a time of religious crisis, but for personal reasons that I try to explain, try to understand, try to fathom in the book that I've written, he also lived this other shadow life away from his workroom, away from the needs and dictates of the church on the streets of Rome. This is a life lived with soldiers, mercenaries, pimps, prostitutes, a very dark and dangerous life.
And yet also one we don't know a great deal about. Is that right?
I think we do. I mean, that's the reason I wrote my book, was because about 12 years ago, I realized that a group of scholars working in places where Caravaggio had been and had left his archival footprint in the documents of the time, this group of scholars had, in effect, although it's 400 years since he died almost, they had found his life. They'd found his rivals, his enemies, his arguments, his fights, his disputes with landladies. And one chap in particular called Sandro Corradini, whose job title is the devil's advocate. He works directly for the Pope, and his job is to establish why somebody shouldn't be a saint if the Pope wants to make them a saint. He spent 30 years of his life as a hobby, when all his colleagues were having their siestas or taking their lunch break, reading some 19 million documents, every document that he could find from the period when Caravaggio was there, barber surgeon reports, wounding reports, assault reports. But he put it all together in a book published in Latin in a privately circulated edition of 100. And it was a dynamite piece of research. And there were several other people who'd also found incredible things. And I just looked at this and thought, well, you know, it's a once-in-a-lifetime chance. You know, you'll only once in your life ever have a chance to completely, you know, rewrite, reshape, recast the life of a great figure.
And he was a great figure, also one who speaks to modernity. How was he viewed in his time? Was he seen as a great artist by his contemporaries? And explain some of the radical innovations that he brought to painting and portraiture.
Well, he entered the world of Italian art in the late 16th century at a moment when it was really, it had run out of steam. People were painting these sort of etiolated late mannerist canvases where all the characters look as if they're in a ballet, even if they're actually performing a martyrdom. Caravaggio made it real. It was his job to make it real as well. He was working for the Franciscans, for the poor orders, for people who felt the church was in a crisis, who wanted art to bring poor people the miserable masses into the church in their thousands. And he did it. And he did it by creating a new kind of cinematically dramatic painting. It's always frozen in the middle of the most dramatic moment of the action. He brought it up to date. His characters wore modern costumes. He brought the scenes of the Bible into the world of his audience. And he did it all with this fantastic cinematic lighting, this light and dark, this chiaroscuro. So he was like a bolt of lightning. And we know that thousands of people would go to a church when a new painting by Caravaggio was going to be displayed. They buzzed like bees, in the words of one contemporary commentator.
And you also point out in the book, and I should mention that many have praised, including our reviewer, Hilary Sperling, just the brilliant analysis and art history in your biography. But there are a couple of places where you show, for instance, how Caravaggio would take one of Michelangelo's great images and import it into his work. Where did the influences come from in his case? How learned a painter was he?
Well, that's one of the things I want to establish in my book. He was a much, much more learned, much more subtle, much more iconographically aware, much more sensitive painter than both his critics or his admirers have allowed. Mm. You know, his admirers see him as a wonderfully dramatic, great realist. His detractors see him as a mere kind of photographer who could pose his figures but had no imagination. He had a sense of drama but no imagination. But what I have tried to unpick in the book is there are deep, deep levels of subtlety. I mean, that wonderful conversion of St. Paul, where he's just painted St. Paul by his horse lying on the ground. But the horse makes the scene feel like a manger. So St. Paul at the moment of his conversion is Christ the child, Christ the infant. And yet his pose with his arms outspread is that of the crucifixion. And it's what Caravaggio has brilliantly telescoped into this image is the idea that at the moment of conversion, Paul experiences, so to speak, mystically, the entire life of Christ in his mind's eye as he's blinded by the divine light of revelation. He's both Christ the child and Christ the crucified.
So what did contemporaries make of this when they saw him? They see this is a great painter, or do they think of him as a kind of eccentric, a curiosity?
Well, one of the challenges, of course, writing this book is there's no such thing as an impartial piece of evidence. So as well as having my art historian hat on, I had to have my detective hat on. Half the time, his contemporaries are his rivals. So his contemporaries are saying things like, oh, well, you know, the Venetians have done this already. There's nothing very original about that. Well, you would say that, wouldn't you, mate? Because you know that Caravaggio is the new guy on the block and he's 20 times better than you.
So they do the same thing our critics do today?
Exactly. That's absolutely right. It's a painter-on-painter kind of warfare. And in fact, one of the chapters in my book that I'm most sort of fond of is the chapter where we get this astonishing, you know, to and fro. Giovanni Baglioni, one of Caravaggio's rivals, massively attacks Caravaggio by painting a parody of one of his pictures, which also tacitly accuses Caravaggio of being a kind of male whore. It paints Caravaggio as a kind of devilish homosexual lurking in the corner of the picture. Caravaggio then responds by, I can't repeat them here, but with some of the most fantastically obscene poetry in the history of sort of skullduggery-type poetry. Baglioni then has Caravaggio thrown into jail, sued for libel. And, you know, and what's wonderful is that we've got, thanks to the research of, as I say, many scholars, not just myself, over the last 50 years or so, in the case of so many of these episodes, different people have found and put together all the documents. So I was able to assemble this kind of composite picture of this argy-bargy between two artists that ends in a libel trial. And it's just wonderfully entertaining stuff. I try to give the reader, you know, as much of the raw history material as I can. That's why the book, you know, it's a bit longer than it might have been, because you get, you know, I try to give you all of Caravaggio's words, all of Baglioni's words. I make my conclusions, but the reader can decide if they agree or if they think I've got it wrong.
Well, it's a major accomplishment. We're so glad you're here to talk about it. Thank you very much.
No, thank you.
That's Andrew Graham Dixon, whose book Caravaggio, A Life Sacred and Profane, is one of the New York Times' 100 notable books of 2011. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, over on the nonfiction side of the list, the only new book is by Glenn Beck. It's Being George Washington, new at number 3. This book is sort of a biography. It's sort of an imagined biography of George Washington that walks you through some of the significant moments in his life with invented dialogue and what was going on in his head. It's pretty ridiculous, actually.
Gee, thanks a lot, Glenn, for upgrading the national consciousness about our founding fathers. Anything else? What about fiction?
Well, the new number one book is Janet Ivanovich's Explosive 18. It debuts right at the top. At this point in her career, pretty much all of these books in her Stephanie Plum series go right to the top of the list. She's really found her audience for those. And then new at number six this week is Micro, which is a new Michael Crichton novel, co-written with Richard Preston of the Hot Zone fame.
Now, Crichton died a number of years ago.
He died in 2008. This is actually his second posthumous bestseller. And back in 2009, he had a Daffy kind of pirate book, Pirate Latitudes, this high seas adventure.
You know, Greg, it's funny about Crichton. He has the reputation for just having cranked out, you know, these not hugely ambitious books. Someone my age remembers when his novel, The Andromeda Strain, was actually taken as an ambitious kind of creative work. Is there more to Crichton than meets the eye?
There is. You're right. He wrote so quickly and often so lazily that it's easy to overlook how smart he really was. But don't forget, he was a trained physician, and he could be surprisingly thoughtful when he wanted to be. Among other things, he was a modern art connoisseur and collector. Back in 1977, he wrote one of the better monographs and biographies of Jasper Johns, contained interviews with him. He knew Johns pretty well. And the new novel has some mentions of modern art in it as well. He was also a skilled critic early in his career. In 1969, in his first big assignment, he reviewed Slaughterhouse-Five for the New Republic, which Charles Shields mentions in his new Vonnegut biography, where he quotes the review. Crichton wrote, "He writes about the most excruciatingly painful things," speaking of Vonnegut. "His novels have attacked our deepest fears of automation and the bomb, our deepest political guilts, our fiercest hatreds and loves. Nobody else writes books on these subjects. They are inaccessible to normal novelistic approaches."
Wow, so kind of a serious guy.
Yeah, but he really was.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thank you, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.